today on Against the Grain. There is a lot of resistance to Donald Trump and his administration and his initiatives. But how can that resistance be built and pursued and articulated most effectively? I'm C.S. Song. You'll hear from three activist organizers who spoke at a recent conference entitled People Get Ready, Building Resistance in the Trump Era, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Resistance to a political project like that undertaken by the Trump administration, and by U.S. elites more generally, works best when it is informed by ideas, by past practice, by a clear-eyed analysis of how power operates in this country. With this in mind, the San Francisco-based Center for Political Education organized a conference held in Berkeley on January 14th. Today, you'll hear excerpts of three talks given at that gathering, talks given by Linda Burnham, Linda Evans, and Mari Maitrei. The Center for Political Education works to build powerful movements and a strong left through education, analysis, theory, dialogue, and activism. It serves as a resource for political organizations on the left, progressive social movements, the working class, and people of color. The conference it organized had the title, People Get Ready, Building Resistance in the Trump Era, and the opening address was delivered by Linda Burnham, an activist, writer, and organizational consultant who's been working on racial justice and peace issues since the 1960s. Burnham co-founded the Women of Color Resource Center and was its executive director for 18 years. She is currently senior advisor to the National Domestic Workers Alliance. Here are portions of Linda Burnham's talk at the People Get Ready conference.
I wanted to start by reading you some words from June Jordan. Everybody know who June Jordan is? She was on this campus for a long time and started Poetry for the People, which I think is still going on. So I wanted to start with June. This is not such a hot time for you or for me. This was not a good time to be gay. Shortly before Wednesday, midnight on a Wednesday, massacre felled 8 homosexual Americans and killed 2. One man was on his way to a delicatessen and the other on his way to a drink. Using an Israeli submachine gun, the killer fired into the crowd, later telling police about the serpent in the garden of his bloody heart, and so forth. This was not a good time to be black. Yesterday, the Senate passed an anti-busing rider, and this morning, the next head of the Senate Judiciary said he would work to repeal the Voter Registration Act, and this afternoon, the Greensboro jury fully acquitted members of the Klan and the American Nazi Party in the murder of 5 citizens, and in Youngstown, Ohio, and in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and in Brooklyn, and in Miami, and in Salt Lake City, and in Portland, Oregon, and in Detroit, Michigan, and in Los Angeles, and in Buffalo, black American women and men were murdered, and the hearts of 2 of the victims were carved from the bodies of the victims, etc. This was not a good time to be married. The Pope has issued directives concerning lust that make for difficult interaction between otherwise interested parties. This was not a good time to be married. This was not a good time to buy a house at 18% interest. This was not a good time to rent housing on a completely decontrolled rental market. This was not a good time to be a Jew when the National Klan agenda targets Jews as well as blacks among its enemies of the purity of the people. This was not a good time to be a tree. This was not a good time to be a river. This was not a good time to be found with a gun. This was not a good time to be found without one. This was not a good time to be gay. This was not a good time to be black. This was not a good time to be a pomegranate or an orange. This was not a good time to be against the natural order. I'm going to come back to June in a little bit. That was a poem of hers called From Sea to Shining Sea. And I think June needs to be in the room with us today. And I brought her into the room for a couple of reasons. So right along through here, I need to turn to people who think a lot deeper than I do and who make connections that I can't make. But June also reminds us to turn to art and music and poetry and your deepest friendships to carry you through dark times. So I want to first off, commend you to some ancestor spirits who knew that you would be right here today, troubled and in trouble. We are not in great times. I want to recommend that you visit with your ancestor warriors, June and Adrian and Audrey in particular. That's June Jordan, Adrian Rich, and Audrey Lord, who will excuse us for rifling through their poems to found the political ones when they were, in fact, also poets of the erotic, the natural world, the ways humans connect and the ways humans don't. But they knew that we'd be right here, right now, and in need of their wisdom, and they're waiting patiently to talk to you, and they're here to help you walk through this. So this is not such a hot time for you or for me. June nailed it. That poem was written in 1982, right? The Reagan years, 35 years ago. So in part, what she's telling us is that some of this is not new. The Trump administration is new. The murder of gay people is not. Trump is new. The murder of black people is not. Trump is new. The turn of government directly against the needs of the people it is supposed to serve is decisively not new. And I want to use this time with you. I haven't come with any ready-made answers. And I'm going to suggest to you that anybody who tells you that they have the ready-made answers is possibly a charlatan. Certainly somebody with an overinflated sense of, you know, whatever. But I do want to identify some questions that really need our collective mind. I want to indicate some of the knotty problems that we're facing right now, right in front of us, and have us think some of that through in order to be able to meet this moment with our most effective and best selves. So, I'm an old girl, so I'm a veteran of many, many, many iterations of political education. Woo! In the way back in the day, we spent a fair amount of time talking about dialectics. The dialectics of this, the dialectics of that. You know, a good part of that time we were talking out of our backsides. We didn't know exactly what we were talking about. But nevertheless, I want to invite you today to do a little bit of dialectical thinking with me. And by that, what I mean really simply is I want to invite you to think with me about how we're holding ideas that are difficult to hold at the same time, how we're holding ideas that seem like they're in opposition to each other or contradictory, how we're holding ideas that seem like they're mutually exclusive, and how we're bringing them into connection with each other, and how making those connections help us move forward. And there are four sets of things I want to talk about, and I'm not going to have time, so I'm going to do shorthand. I'm just going to throw it out there, and you're going to make the most you can out of it, right? Four sets of ideas I want to explore real briefly. First, I want to explore the relationship between short-term and long-term, what our immediate realities and urgencies are, and something about kind of the longer arc and the deeper dynamics, the longer arc of history. I want also for us to think together about what it means to try to figure out how to build the ranks of the left and how to, at the same time, build the broadest possible alignment against authoritarianism. I want us also to think together about the relationship between the part and the whole, the particular and the general. I want us finally to, and briefly, to be in conversation about the relationship between revolutionary imagination and the world as it actually is. So on that first one, short-term, long-term, urgencies of the moment, long arc of struggle, long arc of history. A lot of us woke up on Wednesday, November 9th, and we said, wait a minute. What just happened? We were stunned, and some of us are still reeling. And there's no way to understand what just happened by following the news or following tweets, Trump's tweets. Can't do it that way. We have to follow the news. We have to stay informed about the train wreck that we're right in the middle of. But the news is not going to enlighten us. And so to answer what just happened, we have to step back and put Trump and today's Republican Party into multiple long arc dynamics. Shorthand, capitalist development, the evolution of racialized capital in the US, how capital resolves temporarily its crises. Long and short of it, the dynamics of the highest return on investment leads to the exit of jobs that supported a broad, racialized middle class. Investment not in living wage jobs, but in driving the working class ever deeper into debt, mortgage debt, student loan debt, credit card debt. Why create jobs when you can get a higher return on your investment by creating debt? Entrepreneurs and their PR flacks are posited as job creators, which is a convenient half-truth and sometimes a full-out fiction. Plenty of them are job destroyers. And we're also in the midst of the incapacity and the unwillingness of neoliberal governments to either manage the crises generated by unregulated capital or to extract sufficient taxes from transnationals and wealthy individuals to provide for the public welfare. So that's one long arc that's gotten us where we are. Racial resentment. I'm right now trying to write a piece, and I'm struggling with it, on the kind of liberal panic about identity politics and the white working class. Some of you have followed all of that. It's out there in the world. And one of the things that keeps coming back to me as I'm trying to write that piece is I have on a CD, there's a band that plays underground under Times Square. It's called the Ebony Hillbillies. Long story short, one of the cuts on their CD is, I'd rather be a nigger than a poor white man. So what are they? Yeah, that's a tough one, right? But they're saying something there. What they're saying has to do with suffering from delusions about the master, suffering from delusions about who you actually are, and the very high price you pay for persisting in delusion. So our white brothers and sisters, when things don't quite go right, when that other long arc we just talked about, that arc of capitalist development, comes back and bites you in the butt, those delusions lead to displaced rage and resentment. And here we are. The other piece I want to remind you about, the other arc, more contemporary, because those two like go way, way back, more contemporary Republican strategy. And I commend you to another warrior spirit who, and bring her in the room, Jean Hardesty. And I recommend her book, Mobilizing Resentment. So that you can understand what decades of staying on task on the part of Republicans, implementing a clear strategy of capturing the levers of political power, decades of accommodating the lunatic fringe of Republicanism until the fringe became the whole cloth and the lunatic became the leader. So it's fair to say that those of us who were shocked possibly were not paying attention because they've been at work for a long time. So I'm only trying to indicate that staying current is really important. We have to keep up with the news. We have to keep up with what's going on. But it's not going to get us to the depth we need to fully grasp where we are. So all of this is worth studying more deeply, being put into relationship with the immediate issues of why someone who wants to privatize public education is being put in charge of the Department of Education, and why someone who at bottom would really, really, really prefer if black people didn't vote, why he will be our next attorney general.
Linda Burnham, a movement veteran and left intellectual, speaking on January 14th at a conference called People Get Ready, Building Resistance in the Trump Era. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Due to time constraints, Burnham had to speak in abbreviated ways about especially the second and third ideas, sets of ideas, she mentioned in the excerpt you just heard. With that in mind, let's return to more of Linda Burnham's talk.
So how do we respond to the immediate demands of unfolding events versus strategic orientation to the changing balance of forces? So, okay, long-term, short-term, that first bit was putting the present in the context of the long arcs of the past, multiple arcs of the past. The other bit about short-term, long-term is the relationship between how we respond to unfolding events, how we respond to what's immediately on our agenda, and how we relate that to a strategic orientation to changing the balance of forces over time. There's an urgency to being in the mix. There's an urgency to being responsive to unfolding events. I'm personally getting on a plane on Wednesday to go to the Women's March. Woohoo! Hello! And I know that the Women's March is not gonna be enough. We can march, we can generate online petitions, we can protest one Trumpian outrage after the other. But the fact of the matter is that the left is bereft of strategy. Can I get an amen on that?
Amen.
Yes, thank you. Okay. So if we only march and do petitions and protest each and every outrage, which we will exhaust ourselves, people, right? We will exhaust ourselves. The tactical moves outside the context of a coherent strategy do not create the ground for forward momentum, for shifting power, for creating new and better conditions for us to fight in. Somewhere, and we are the ones, all right? There isn't some other set of people in a room somewhere developing strategy. Okay? I know that. I've been all over the country. Okay? We are the ones in this case. We are the ones. So, I'm hoping you all have defeat Trump in 2020 on your agenda. I hope we can unite on that and commit ourselves to the practical work of making that happen. That doesn't resolve any of those long-term dynamics. Not a one. So I put to you for your further thinking the dialectic of the immediate, the moment, the fierce urgency of now as against what history has bequeathed us, the long term, the long arc, the imperatives of the future. building the ranks of the left while building the broadest possible front against authoritarianism. So I'm hoping most of us in this room agree that the most urgent task in front of us is to contribute to building the broadest possible alliance of social and political forces and aim that alignment at defeating Trumpism, authoritarianism, bigoted, nativist, misogynistic right. And we need to learn how to identify the whole country as the terrain of our politics. The whole country as the terrain of our politics. Or we'll fail. It's as simple as that. We need to have a long-term orientation in a period when unions are in steep decline, in a period of skillful, pervasive messaging from the right, in a period of pain and shame in poor white communities. What do we bring to that? What do we have to offer?
A lot.
Thank you. Thank you. But we got to dig deep. As I tell lots of activists, and I'm sure some of you have heard me say this, so forgive me if you have. I want everybody every day to wake up and look at the electoral map. And remember that you're fighting for the whole country, not your county. In doing that, it requires that we beat back the alienation, whatever horrendous experience you might have had driving through Indiana, living in some small town in whatever state. We have to work on figuring out, developing the most affirmative, conscious relationship we can between whatever particular issues and experiences brought you to politics, whatever issues you are championing, and the process of moving the country as a whole to better ground. Fourth, revolutionary imagination and the world as it is. All I want to say here is don't substitute your revolutionary imagination for the brutal realities we currently face. And don't let the brutal realities we currently face to subdue or constrain your revolutionary imagination. We need the you who is practical and effective and relentlessly clear-eyed about what we're presently facing and what it will take us to get from here to someplace better. But we also need the you who is driven by the certainty that we can do much, much, much better. The one who knows that humans have the knowledge and skills and resources and humanity to create a world that's free of want and full of love. So I encourage you to work on the relationship between your revolutionary imagination and the world as it is. I want to tell you a story. In the days following the election, I was like, really, white people? This is what you brought us? Really? And I walked into, on the Thursday following the Tuesday, I walked into a room full of white people, and I'll admit to you, it was a yoga class. And I realized I was raging, right? I was raging. These are people I practice with every week. They're lovely people. And I was raging, and I could barely catch my breath. I could barely catch my breath. It took me a while. And you're supposed to be breathing in yoga. That's the whole point. It took me a long time to get to work my way through that. So why am I telling you this? One of the things that Audre Lorde said in the same essay where you'll find Master's Tools, Master's House, she said, I urge each one of us here to reach down into that deep place of knowledge inside herself and touch that terror and loathing of any difference that lives there. See whose face it wears. So all that rage, all that unfocused fury, that was wearing my face. That was my face. So I'm saying that to you because it's at least possible that somebody in here between November 8th and today has had a negative emotion or two. And maybe this is another dialectic, I don't know. We need you to bring your best self. That nasty, rageful, unfocused, resentful self. We need you to figure out how to set that down. You need to find the people who can withstand all your negative energy and still love you. Find those people. You need to find the ones who can tell you to stay in the house until you can find and present a better version of you. I'm serious. Because I can come out looking really bad. You need to find the ones who will remind you to do whatever it takes to restore you to your brilliant, generous self, ready to meet the moment and the world, and ready to interact with our multiracial, multiethnic, multigendered, all faiths, no particular faith, beautiful, confused working class. Has anybody in here heard of the Lady Parts Justice League? Hey, so for those of you who have not, the Lady Parts Justice League is organizing a snatchback event, snatchback. And at that event, there's going to be singing, they're going to be drinking songs, there's a musical, a whole musical written about tampon applicators, there's going to be cheering for the Pussy Grabs Back brass band. Hello. So why am I telling you that? I'm telling you that because there are opportunities galore out there for organizing. The moment is demanding something of us, but sometimes the news is so constant and so overwhelming that we can't catch our breath and figure out what our best contribution is. The Pussy Grabs Back brass band is not sitting around waiting to figure out what their best contribution is. They've figured it out. They have figured it out, right? So there's a moment, in a moment of chaos, a moment of chaos is also a moment of creativity. It's a moment of generative spirit. People want connection. I've had conversations with people I've never had conversations with before. They've gone deep. So it's for us to meet people where they are, to learn from them and incorporate their experience and understanding in the world into your store of knowledge about this complicated world we live in, and to share with them what you've learned from your years of organizing and study. Get with your people and figure out what your best contribution is in this moment. What do I need to do to change in my life, to change in my organization, to bring that contribution? And how does that contribution relate to all those other dialectics we talked about? The part, the whole, the short term, long term, core, front, imagination, reality. I have to close, but I'm going to read you the rest of that poem if I can find it. I haven't read the whole thing. I want you to go back and I want you yourselves to go find it. So I'm closing with June. So you'll remember June said, "This is not such a hot time for you or for me." At the end of the poem, here's what she says. She says, "Wait a minute. Sucked by the tongue and the lips while the teeth release the succulents of all voluptuous disintegration, I am turning under the trees. I am trailing blood into the rivers. I am walking loud along the streets. I am digging my nails and my heels into the land. I am opening my mouth. I am just about to touch the pomegranates, piled up, precarious. This is a good time. This is the best time. This is the only time to come together. Fractious, kicking, spilling, burly, whirling, raucous, messy, free, exploding like the seeds of natural disorder."
That was Linda Burnham speaking recently at UC Berkeley. Burnham is a longtime racial justice and anti-war activist. She was a leader in the Third World Women's Alliance, and she edited the anthology Changing the Race, Racial Politics and the Election of Barack Obama. You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. We turn next to another presenter at the People Get Ready conference convened by the Center for Political Education. Linda Evans is a former political prisoner and an organizer with All of Us or None, a grassroots organization fighting for the rights of formerly and currently incarcerated people and their families. Here's some of what Linda Evans had to say at the conference.
I feel like when I look at the news, I mean, we are in some kind of crisis of democracy, crisis of capitalism, crisis of the Constitution. What does that mean for us? How do we look at it and figure out what to do? I feel overwhelmed. I'm sure a lot of you do too. But the only thing that we can do is put one foot in front of the other and really learn from the mistakes that we make, learn from what we've done before, and try to share the lessons that we do learn as we go along. Because there is such urgency and such demand for us to really participate and take charge of the direction of our movement that we can't hold back. We have to be willing to take risks. We have to be willing to make mistakes. I know that one of the things that we really do have to confront is our own fears. If we're going to step forward and really take on the struggle against Trump, we're going to have to examine what are we afraid of and get past it. Because I think that the example of the civil rights movement and of the comrades that came before us is really, really relevant here. Recently, I read John Lewis's book called March. It's a graphic novel, 3 volumes, very accessible. I recommend it. And understanding how the resistance built at that mass level that included everybody in the community standing up is, I think, the lesson that we have to take. How do we build that same determination, that same bravery, that same courage to resist that the civil rights comrades, our leaders, our ancestors came to? How did they do that? I think that I want to share some lessons that I've learned from various efforts to organize in my life. And basically, there are 3 arenas that I want to talk about. One is, I worked with the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee for many years, long ago in the 1980s. Some of you probably were just being born. But We directly confronted the Ku Klux Klan. And we were an internationalist organization. We worked against white supremacy in South Africa by fighting apartheid and against Israeli domination of the Middle East by supporting the Palestinians. We worked in solidarity with Native American people, with the struggle for Puerto Rican independence. So we understood that the forces of white supremacy, like Phil was talking about, are and always have been international. And for us to truly build a resistance movement, we need to develop communications with people in other parts of the world who have confronted white supremacy, perhaps under different conditions, but with lessons that we can learn from. So I think that's a very important part of what maybe a few years ago we would have called globalization of the people's struggle. One of the things that we did then, which was different than now, because of course we have the internet now, we didn't then, I know that seems unbelievable, but we didn't have it, was that we did a lot of personal outreach. And I want everybody to just think about that for a minute and whether in fact that is not obsolete. It's easy to send out emails, to do, you know, Facebook and Twitter and all that stuff. It isn't the same as organizing. I'm not saying it doesn't have a role. I think it's really important. Obviously, we need to use every tool that we can. But in terms of really changing people's minds and their consciousness, I think that we have to engage in conversation, in struggle with each other, in discussion, and that cannot be, there's no substitute for that. During that time in John Brown Anti-Klan Committee, the Ku Klux Klan was in Texas, where I was working, was extremely public. They had a TV show on the community access radio station, TV station. They did marches. They had paramilitary training camps on national forest land. They were working hard to organize their people. One of the things that the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee did that was very successful in terms of changing people's minds was we did a door-to-door petition against the Klan training camps. Now today, you can get a petition signed online and get, you know, 100,000 or 50,000 or whatever signatures in a heartbeat. But are those people going to really confront the Klan? Are they really going to confront white supremacy? Do they have a practice of doing that? Do they understand how to intervene if they see a racist interaction happening in their local Starbucks, right? So I think that if we look at white supremacy today and the way that now there's no pretense of who is running this government, we have to look at the ways, at the various places that white supremacy happens. Some of it is in individuals. And I think it's incumbent on everybody in this room, if you see a racist interaction happening, act in solidarity with the person that's being attacked. It sounds like it might be easy, but we know that to intervene with strangers is not always that easy, but it's something we must do. It must be part of our practice. Then we have the organized Ku Klux Klan, the organized white supremacist forces. It's important to call them out, to identify them, and to confront their organizing. Obviously, we need to do that in collective, not as individuals. But it's critical that we understand how they're organizing themselves, what their organizations look like. There's many of them. And build a strategy to confront them wherever they try to march, wherever they try to organize. It's many places. They're organizing in the prisons. They're organizing pretty much everywhere. And I think it's really critical that we confront that organizational level. Another place it's going to come up is white supremacy in the state, right? We're going to have to call it out. Certainly, Vision for Black Lives, the Movement for Black Lives, Black Lives Matter, are leaders in that. And it's crucial that we follow that leadership. I also have learned a lot of lessons from building a movement of formerly incarcerated people. And specifically, we've worked around Ban the Box. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that. The box refers to that question on employment, housing, social benefits, applications. Do you have a conviction? If you do, forget it. You're not getting anything. So we confronted that box in various arenas, housing, education, employment, voting rights, And all over the country, formerly incarcerated people started to build movement in their towns, in their counties, in their states, and has been incredibly successful as a reform. What we need to do, however, I believe one of the weaknesses of what we have built is that we haven't developed a political consciousness that goes beyond that reform to what is a vision. What is a vision of some of a better society, something that can encourage and inspire us, that we can work toward? That needs to be developed further. And I think also internally, there still are contradictions around male supremacy and around how do we build something that's going to last a long time, that isn't dependent on individuals, but that has an ideology and a strategy that can move forward no matter who is participating or leading at any moment. The other thing I think that really the work around formerly incarcerated people points to is the need for that long arc. We still have political prisoners who have been locked up for 40 years. We all need to educate ourselves about those comrades and move forward to get them free. I just want to say one more thing about fighting white supremacy and the lessons that we can learn from the hunger strike, the California prison hunger strike, and from the agreement to end hostilities. Nothing is more divided than prison life. The state segregates us. We end up segregating ourselves because of fear, because of influences from the outside. And what the people did, what the people in prison did, was built unity. Out of the secure housing units, where people are kept in solitary confinement 23 hours a day, never get to talk to each other or to any other human beings, have no physical contact with another person. Under the worst conditions that you can imagine, they built unity and built demands, and they built solidarity with people on the outside that were able to actually move forward some of the demands and actually win some of the demands. It was a long struggle. People died. The agreement to end hostilities was a statement was a unified statement by the prisoners who started the hunger strike, by the comrades in the short quarter at Pelican Bay Prison. And it was a statement of common cause against a common enemy. And I think it's crucial that we understand their example, follow that leadership, and build that same understanding amongst ourselves, where we appreciate and respect the differences and learn from the differences amongst us. Keep in mind that the leadership and experience and expertise of people most directly affected must guide our work, and then we must build unity to confront Trump and his administration.
Linda Evans is her name. She spoke at a conference called People Get Ready, Building Resistance in the Trump Era, held 2 months ago at UC Berkeley. I'm CS, this is Against the Grain, and we move now to portions of a presentation given by Mari Maitreyi. Maitreyi is a South Asian Dalit diasporic activist and an organizer with the Alliance of South Asians Taking Action. Mari Maitreyi began with this explanation of what is meant by the caste system.
So, you know, it's essentially like a structure of social inequality that is set up all over South Asia, and so that means not only India, but Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Tamil Eelam, Nepal, where people are divided into groups in a sort of a pyramid feudal structure. So you have some people on the top of that pyramid with incredible access to knowledge, to resources, to capital, to land, and then you have, you know, people with decreasing access stepwise. And you have people outside of this pyramid completely, those people without caste, who have been violently sort of exploited and continue to experience very violent exploitation and social exclusion on many fronts throughout South Asia. And so some of the people who are outside of the caste system are Dalits, who were formerly known as untouchables because it was spiritually polluting to touch us, and Adivasis, who are the indigenous peoples of South Asia. So there's kind of like, you know, there's kind of like this myth that caste is long gone. It's an ancient sort of system that doesn't exist anymore, but really it's quite pervasive. It exists everywhere, and we continue to see Dalits, Adivasis, lower caste peoples experience like bodily violence, so rape, murder, burnings, lynchings, continue to happen into 2016. But also there's like all these structures that are set up where they're excluded from universities, for example, or access to capital, so work, jobs. The ability to have sort of a dignified life is still kept from them. So the other sort of thing that people talk about is caste doesn't really exist in the diaspora, because we're all like, we moved out of the old world and like we're better people now. And it's not true, because it really exists. It exists here. It exists wherever people who have identified as Hindu have taken their religion and gone. So it exists here, it exists in Europe, it exists in Australia, it exists in the Caribbean, in Fiji, Mauritius, wherever we are, we've taken it with us. And, you know, one example I like to give is, you know, there are many examples in that a lot of South Asians still continue to sort of intermarry within their own caste. We'll have friend and professional networks that are casted, but not admitting it. You know, in places of worship, there are certain casted people who can take leadership positions and those who cannot. So it manifests in those ways. But the example that I like to give is the example of immigration for non-whites in America in the late 1800s. There was a law that prevented anyone who was not white from getting American citizenship. And so the first non-white person to actually get American citizenship was an upper caste Hindu man who made the argument in court that as a result of him being upper caste, he was actually racially superior. He was racially Aryan. And therefore, he deserved citizenship as much as any other Caucasian / Aryan origin person should. And he was granted citizenship for a short while before they did revoke it, because they were like, oh, that's not good enough. It's not the white that's good enough. But so this sort of Aryanism, the concept of Aryanism, is like a good segue to talk about Hindu fascism. And Hindu fascism is really an ideology that is called Hindutva. That's the name of the ideology. And it's based on this idea of Hindu race, so superior race, Aryanism, Hindu land, so all of South Asia is Hindu and belongs to people who are Hindu. Hindu language, as Hindi is Hindu language, and Hindu religion. So, and this is a sort of ideology that is disastrous for the truth of South Asia, because the truth of South Asia is that we are way more diverse and way more just, we have so many tribes, so many castes, so many religions, so many cultures, that it's not possible to bring us together in that way. It's not possible to try to make nations Hindu nations and exclude everybody else. So what we see is this ideology, which actually started as a reaction to white colonialism before independence for India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, we see that now it has really grown, really become very strong, and has a lot of political power. So the current party that is ruling in India is the BJP, and they are the political wing of the Hindutva bird. And the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, was actually he was convicted of aiding and abetting the massacre of thousands of Muslims in the state of Gujarat in 2001 when he was the chief minister there. But he still got elected in 2014. And a lot of us had the feelings, you know, we felt when he was elected like we feel now when Trump is elected.
And now we skip ahead to Mari Maitreyi talking about a textbook battle in California that the Alliance of South Asians Taking Action got involved in.
As you may know, like California School Board, I think they open up their textbook frameworks for review once in 6 years. and then people can go and they can submit edits or comments or on things that they thought were not accurate or that the community wanted to change. And what we began to see is that very quietly, two or three quote-unquote Hindu organizations, very well-funded, were submitting these edits that were really trying to present South Asia in the light of Hindutva ideology, mm-hmm. in the light of Hindutva history. So broadly, they were asking for edits that wanted to refer to all of South Asia as India. So in places where they would write ancient South Asia, they would ask for edits saying ancient India. And so this erases the history of Pakistan, of Bangladesh, of Sri Lanka, all of these other countries that are modern nations that, you know, in the time of ancientness, 3,000 years ago or whatever, didn't really exist in that way. The other thing that was really on their list was the erasure of caste. So removing the teaching tool for caste, which is a pyramid like I described, from the textbooks. Removing words that said caste continues to exist. Removing words that said that caste is religiously sanctioned by Hinduism. And then the third line of edits, of course, was an Islamophobic line of edits, where they were like, Islam and to some extent Christianity are Western religions. They're not native to South Asia. They're not native to India in particular. And therefore, you have to present this history as merely a history of invasion and violence and coercive conversion to Islam. And so what we did was we formed a sort of, you know, they were working for a longer time and they were well-funded and they had like a great, you know, they had strategists. I think they had publicists who were like publicists for like Silicon Valley guys. And we were like this loosely assembled coalition of community members who were Dalits, Adivasis, Buddhist, Christians, Muslims from the local area. Six, and we went in and we testified and we said, no, we don't want these edits because these edits are misrepresenting the truth of the history of South Asia. And we did campaigns and we got together our people and we won back a lot of the really disturbing edits. And I think that really happened with Dalit and Muslim leadership at the core of that organizing. And so I really want to make the point that, like, understanding how we work together in an international way also means learning a lot about the complexities of our communities.
Mari Maitreyi organizes with the Alliance of South Asians Taking Action. ASADA is a Bay Area-based group working to educate, organize, and empower the Bay Area's South Asian communities to end violence, oppression, racism, and exploitation against and within those communities. She's also research director of Equality Labs. Mari Maitreyi spoke at the People Get Ready conference, held on January 14th and organized by the Center for Political Education. I want to thank the center's co-directors, Rachel Herzing and Isaac Ontiveros, for furnishing the audio, which has been edited by yours truly. More information about the Center for Political Education and about the conference can be found at politicaleducation.org. And this is Sia suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.